Good morning. It's 7:08 and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter.
And as we speak, the House Judiciary Committee Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights and Civil Liberties has just started convening a hearing on reparations for African Americans. Technically a hearing on House Resolution 40, a bill first enrolled in the Congress by John Conyers in 1989, has not gotten a hearing for the past decade of Republican control in the House. We're going to be trying to bring you as much of the testimony as possible live this morning. It'll include testimony by Ta-Nehisi Coates, by Danny Glover, by Julianne Malveau. And we're going to join the opening remarks by the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties Chair, Democrat Steve Cohn of Tennessee.
The role of the federal and state governments in supporting slavery and racial discrimination, other forms of discrimination against the descendants of slaves, and the lingering consequences of slavery and Jim Crow on African Americans. The commission will also make recommendations as to appropriate ways to educate the American public about its findings and appropriate remedies in light of its findings. An honest reckoning with the federal government's role in protecting the institution of slavery has been a leading priority of my congressional career. In 2007, my freshman year, less than 2 months into that term, I introduced H. Res. 194, an apology by the House of Representatives for its role in perpetuating both slavery and its noxious offspring, Jim Crow. The House ultimately passed this resolution by voice vote, and I once again thank Chairman Conyers for getting it a vote and getting it to the American people. As I noted in my resolution then, it was not just slavery itself that was wrong, but also, quote, the visceral racism against persons of African descent upon which, unquote, American slavery depended, a racism that went on to become entrenched in the nation's social fabric, an evil that we must continue to confront today. Can we get that door closed?
Okay.
Thank you, sir. My resolution emphasizes that while slavery was our nation's original sin, the underlying sin of anti-black racism did not end with the Civil War and the 13th Amendment, and Congress's inaction and acquiescence in the face of such racism was a big reason why. Racism became only further entrenched after slavery's end, as reflected in societal attitudes and in Jim Crow laws, a system of state racial segregation laws that created separate and unequal societies for whites and African Americans, one that was enforced through both official means and through lynchings, violence, intimidation, and disenfranchisement. And not until 100 years after the end of slavery did Congress, under pressure from Dr. Martin Luther King, John Lewis, and other great civil rights leaders in the civil rights movement, finally carry out its duty to end Jim Crow by passing the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that still exists to some extent, and other core civil rights statutes, better fulfilling the Constitution's guarantees of equal protection for all. Today, our nation continues to struggle with the legacy of the anti-black racism and undergirded slavery and Jim Crow. We see this in statistics that paint a bleak picture. According to the Census Bureau, 21.2% of African Americans lived in poverty in 2017, compared to 8.7% of non-Hispanic whites who live in poverty. That's over two times as many. The Census Bureau also reported in 2015 that the net worth of African-American households was only about $13,000, which was less than 10%, of the nearly $140,000 net worth of non-Hispanic white households. Limited access to wealth, building resources, and opportunities have led to this stark disparity. For instance, African-Americans continue to face discrimination in the workplace. They have limited access to educational opportunities. According to the National Education Association, the high school education rate, graduation rate for African-Americans was 67% compared to the nationwide average of 81%. African-Americans also continue to face racial segregation in housing and discrimination in the availability of quality health care service and most other major facets of life. Enacting H.R. 40 would be an important step in finding effective long-term solutions to these problems, ones that can trace their origins to our nation's shameful history of slavery and anti-black racism. As the distinguished Professor Charles Ogletree of Harvard Law School once noted, the concept of reparations does not necessarily mean payments to individuals, but rather a focus on the poorest of the poor, including efforts, quote, to address comprehensively the problems of those who have not substantially benefited from integration or affirmative action, unquote. I hope our hearing today can lead to fruitful conversations with the aim of achieving that goal. I thank our witnesses for being here today and look forward to their testimony. It is now my pleasure to recognize the ranking member of the subcommittee, the gentleman from Louisiana, Mr. Johnson, for his opening statement. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me start
Memphis,
today by saying
white
I maintain
Democrats
the utmost respect for my colleagues
black
on the
district.
Other side, and I know their beliefs on this issue are sincerely held. I want to thank all our witnesses for being here today, for your good faith testimony and your scholarship. We've all read through it in detail and made many notes. I'll use my brief time here to just focus on an overview of what H.R. 40 is and why we're here. What we're going to discuss here today centers upon a regrettable and shameful portion of American history. Slavery in America and elsewhere was a horrific injustice, the perpetuation of which was antithetically opposed to the founding ideals expressed in our Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, including its Bill of Rights. Of course, the evil institution of slavery was legally abolished over 150 years ago on December 6, 1865, via ratification of the 13th Amendment, following the end of the tragic Civil War. The bill today, H.R. 40, would, quote, establish a commission to study and develop reparation proposals for African Americans. There are serious questions about this from all sides of the political spectrum, and they're honest and sincere questions that we want to address. But putting aside the injustice of monetary reparations from current taxpayers for the sins of a small subset of Americans from many generations ago, The fair distribution of reparations would be nearly impossible once one considers the complexity of the American struggle to abolish slavery. Just consider this, okay? There are tens of millions of today's non-African Americans who are descended from people who arrived in the country, of course, after slavery ended. And therefore, they can't be held responsible for its legacy. More tens of millions are descended from people in both the North and South who didn't own slaves or who were descended from white people who fought in the Civil War on the Union side. Indeed, only a small percentage of the total American population were slave owners. For the aforementioned reasons and many others, such an approach has been widely unpopular, at least in our recent history. In the 1970s, civil rights organizations openly rejected the idea of reparations, which the NAACP's assistant director himself called, quote, an illogical, diversionary, and paltry way out for guilt-ridden whites, unquote. Bayard Rustin, who organized the 1963 March on Washington and was one of Martin Luther King Jr.'s closest advisors, described the concept as, quote, a ridiculous idea, unquote. Barack Obama opposed reparations when he ran for president in 2008, and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders did as well 8 years later. In addition to all this, here in the Judiciary Committee, we have an obligation to acknowledge that any monetary reparations that might be recommended by the commission created by H.R. 40 would almost certainly be unconstitutional on their face. The reason for that, listen, wait a minute. The reason for that is a legal question. See, the legal question is, the federal government can't constitutionally provide compensation today to a specific racial group because other members of that group, maybe several generations ago, were discriminated against and treated inhumanely. According to the U.S. Supreme Court, they would refer to that as an unconstitutional racial preference. See, the holding of the 1995 case, Richmond v. G.A. Cross and Company, is that racial set-asides and other entitlements are only constitutionally permissible to remedy the present effects of the government's own widespread and recent discrimination. And the federal government is not allowed to provide race-based remedies that are, quote, ageless in their reach into the past and timeless in their ability to affect the future, unquote. Now listen, I get it. I've read the scholarship. I know that some proponents of this legislation believe that the very discussion of reparations itself would be cathartic for our nation. But we have to ask if discussions can result in justice today. They certainly probably won't provide consensus. Instead, many people of good conscience believe they'll distract from the many persistent causes of current racial disparities. They certainly exist. The despicable racism of America's past is part of that, as Mr. Coates, for example, has documented in a very compelling way. But so are other social and cultural dynamics, which are themselves often negatively influenced by well-intended government policies. Let us be clear today. Racism violates the most fundamental principles of our great nation, and it breaks the heart of our just and loving God. The central idea of America, what has been called as our foundational creed, is that we boldly declare the self-evident truths that all men are created equal, and that we are thus endowed by our Creator with the same inalienable rights. Because each of us is made in the image of God, every single person has inestimable dignity and value. And our value is not related in any way to the color of our skin, what neighborhood we live in, our intelligence, or our abilities. Our value is inherent because it is given to us by our Creator. Many of my colleagues in this committee may not be aware that in addition to our four children still at home, my wife Kelly and I actually have a much older son who happens to be African American. We took custody of Michael and made him part of our family 22 years ago when we were just newlyweds, and Michael was just 14 and out on the streets and nowhere to go and on a very dangerous path. Michael's grown now. He has his own young family. He turns 36 years old next week, and he's a loving dad to four precious children of his own. God's been good to us, and he's a success story. I mention that today for one reason. I personally know the challenge that he has faced early in his life. I have walked with him through discrimination that he's had to endure over the years and the hurdles he's sometimes faced. I know all this, but I was with him. I asked Michael this weekend what he thinks about the idea of reparations. In a very thoughtful way, he explained his opposition, and it reminded me of something that Harvard history professor Stephen Thernstam has previously testified in this very committee, and he said this quote as I'm wrapping up. Finally, I would urge the members of this subcommittee and the House of Representatives as a whole to ponder carefully the message that will be conveyed by the passage of this bill, H.R. 40. When you are behind in a foot race, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1963, the only way to get ahead is to run faster than the man in front of you. So when your white roommate says he's tired and goes to sleep, you stay up and burn the midnight oil. Dr. King's words reflect an important tradition of self-reliance, I'm still quoting, that has had eloquent advocates in the African-American community. Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, and many others. All of them were saying in their different ways that African Americans were not powerless to better their lives until America owned up to its historical sins and offered them a generous financial settlement. The point is as important today as ever. That's what he wrote to this committee the last time, or one of the last times this was debated. Those great leaders encourage people to take control of and responsibility for their own lives because that gives every human being a greater sense of meaning, purpose, and satisfaction. And I know everybody in this room probably agrees with that idea, that principle. The premise of H.R. 40 and similar legislation, however well-intended they may be, risks communicating the opposite message. Would it propagate a worldview that says external forces from a century and a half ago are directing the fate of Black Americans today? I mean, it's an honest question some people ask. I think people who wholeheartedly agree that our nation is still in the process of healing from its reprehensible sins of the past can ask that question. There's no doubt that prejudice exists in our society just as it has in every society since the fall of man in the garden. It exists in many communities and between many different races and types of people, sadly, and it is not reserved to just one race or class or ethnicity against another. We all know that. All of it is despicable, and every single instance of it is un-American. The question, the honest question we have today, and that's what we're here to discuss, is what do we do about it? All of us are here to listen to the thoughtful discussion today. I hope we'll do it respectfully and with civility. We approach it in good faith. I promise you, every member of Congress does. And I look forward to hearing from all of our witnesses. Thank you again. I yield back.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And I want to.
That was Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, ranking Republican on the committee.
Respond or speak out or applaud or
chair.
Cheer. And I'm probably.
Democrat Steve Cohen of Tennessee.
Encouraged and allowed what I think was a proper reverence for Mr. Conyers. But if you'd not allow my error to be compounded, try to keep cool. And I'd now like to recognize the chairman of the full committee, Mr. Nadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman,
Nadler,
for calling this important
hearing. Chair of the House Judiciary Committee. This is a subcommittee of that committee.
This year we mark the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans arriving at the colony of Jamestown, Virginia. Today's hearing on H.R. 40 and the path to restorative justice gives us the opportunity to reflect on the shameful legacy of slavery and Jim Crow in this country, and to examine how we can best move forward as a nation. For nearly three decades, the former chairman of the Judiciary Committee, John Conyers of Michigan, introduced H.R. 40, which would establish a commission to study reparations proposals for African Americans. Our colleague, the gentlewoman from Texas, Ms. Jackson Lee, has taken up sponsorship of this legislation, and I am pleased to be a co-sponsor, as I was a co-sponsor for many years when it was sponsored by Mr. Conyers. H.R. 40 is intended to begin a national conversation about how to confront the brutal mistreatment of African Americans during chattel slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and the enduring structural racism that remains endemic to our society today. Even long after slavery was abolished, segregation and subjugation of African Americans was a defining part of this nation's policies that shaped its values and its institutions. Today, we live with racial disparities in access to education, health care, housing, insurance, employment, and other social goods that are directly attributable to the damaging legacy of slavery and government-sponsored racial discrimination in this century following slavery's end. It is important to recognize that H.R. 40 makes no conclusion about how to properly atone for and make recompense for the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and their lingering consequences. Instead, it sets forth a process by which a diverse group of experts and stakeholders can study the complex issues involved and make recommendations to us. Most serious reparations models that have been proposed to date have focused on restorative community-based programs of employment, healthcare, housing, and education initiatives, righting wrongs that cannot be fixed with checks alone. This moment of national reckoning comes at a time when our nation must find constructive ways to confront a rising tide of racial and ethnic division. In April, this committee held a hearing on hate crimes and the rise of white nationalism in order to begin framing a federal response. Hate crimes, white supremacy, the legacy of slavery, the legacy of Jim Crow, all hold back our country's longstanding efforts to carry out what the preamble to our Constitution says it is designed to do, to form a more perfect union. Reparations in the context of H.R. 40 are ultimately about respect and reconciliation, and the hope that one day all Americans can walk together toward a more just future. I hope that the commission established by H.R. 40 can help us better comprehend our own history and bring us closer to racial understanding and advancement and justice. Today's hearing gives the subcommittee an important opportunity to hear from witnesses directly involved in shaping the discourse on healing our society and creating a path to restorative justice. I am pleased that we have such a distinguished panel of witnesses whose testimony will assist us greatly in understanding the scope of our inquiry. The discussion of reparations is a journey in which the road traveled may be almost as important as the exact destination. I am pleased that the subcommittee is beginning this process today, and I look forward to hearing from our witnesses. I yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Nadler.
That was Jerry Nadler, like Democrat who chairs the House Judiciary Committee. This is the chair, Stephen Cohen, Democrat from Tennessee.
A member of the committee, but not the subcommittee, without objection. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Bass. And Mr. Green was just here from Houston. I think he's coming back. And now I'd like to recognize the gentlelady from Texas for an opening statement, Ms. Sheila Jackson Lee.
Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat.
Chairman, thank you very much.
County,
and
Texas.
Thank you to Chairman Nadler for identity of H.R. 4 as a legitimate legislative action that should receive the full hearing of this committee, should in fact have a markup, go to the floor of the House, go to the United States Senate, and be signed by the President of the United States of America. This is a action of legislative commitment, and this is not a symbolic action, though I am gratified that we are having this hearing on Juneteenth. And for those of us who understand Juneteenth, 2 years after the proclamation, Emancipation Proclamation, there were those Africans who did not have freedom until 1865. So let me begin and indicate to my friends who have expressed a variety of assessments of H.R. 40 and say that America is a place that welcomes the diversity of thought. We even welcome the diversity of thought among the multicolored chocolate people that are African Americans, descendants of African slaves. Let me be very clear. It is only this group, even though they attempted to enslave Native Americans, it is only this group that can singularly claim to have been slaves under the auspices, the institution, and leadership of the United States government. And so H.R. 40 is in fact the response of the United States of America long overdue. Slavery is the original sin. Slavery has never received an apology. This commission will be comprised of members selected by the President of the United States, the Speaker of the House, the leader, and of course, those who've been entrenched in this process. I spoke to John Conyers yesterday. I'm honored to have been given the opportunity to lead this bill. John Conyers said to move on and to lead on, and for us, to take this forward. Thank you, Congressman John Conyers, for all that you have done. So let me share with you just a sense of what we face. Let me first of all say the number of Africans who died in the Middle Passage, over 2 million. Number of enslaved who died during slavery, first, second, and third generation, over 2.5 million. The transatlantic slave trade was the largest movement of people in history. Between 10 and 15 million Africans were forcibly transported across the Atlantic between 1500 and 1900. At least 2 million Africans, 10 to 15%, died in the infamous Middle Passage, as I said, and another 15 to 30% died during the march to or confinement along the coast. Altogether, for every 100 slaves who reached the New World, another 40 died in Africa or during the Middle Passage. Who has a history like that? Reparations and the idea of this commission should be welcomed by all Americans. For we are not asking one American to give one payment. What we're saying is it's the only way that slavery ended was a governmental action of the 13th Amendment, governmental action. And Reconstruction failed after 12 years because it was imploded by governmental people. And after Reconstruction, a reign of terror that had never been seen, the hanging fruit, the lynching, the oppression of voting, the tearing away of land, and the amazing concept of the continuing de jure and de facto impact of slavery today. 1 million African Americans are incarcerated. That is a continuing impact. The black employment rate is 6.6%, in spite of what has been said currently, more than double the national unemployment rate. 31% of black children live in poverty compared to 11% of white children. The national average is 18%, which suggests that the percentage of black children living in poverty is more than 150%. Even in spite of the glorious overcoming of the talent that is part of our community, the scrapping together of making sure our children received education, the putting together something out of nothing, we still have been impacted. And only 57% of black students have access to full range of math and science classes today. Black children were vaccinated at rates lower than white children. Education mobility has been limited. Black children represent 19% of the nation's preschool population, yet 47% of those receiving more than one out-of-school suspension. Black students are 2.3 times as likely to receive a referral to law enforcement. And we know the criminal justice system. So I conclude by these words. Black people in America are the descendants of Africans kidnapped and transported to the United States with the explicit complicity of the U.S. government and every arm of the United States lawmaking and law enforcement infrastructure. The dehumanizing and atrocities of slavery were not isolated occurrences, but mandated by federal laws that were codified and enshrined in the Constitution. The role of the federal government in supporting the institution of slavery and subsequent discrimination directed against blacks is an injustice that must be formally acknowledged and addressed. I am not here in anger or anguish. I am not in any way seeking to encourage hostilities. There are diverse opinions in this room, and I understand it, appreciate it, respect it, admire it, and love it. I'm a product of my history. I am clearly a child that has walked this path. No, I did not pick cotton. But I will say that those who picked cotton created the very basic wealth of this nation. For cotton was king. There was no other product. And so I ask my fellow colleagues that this is simply a constructive discussion that will lead to the practical responses. And if I might, Mr. Chairman, put this article in the record from the New York Times, dated June 17th, downtown boom, Kansas City, Missouri, and just a few blocks away, devastation in the black community. Two cities, mostly in every area, I ask unanimous consent, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection.
Two cities, I also ask unanimous consent to put a statement of support from John Legend.
Without objection.
Two cities, Mr. Chairman. And so let me just conclude by saying I hope that we come in peace. I know that we'll hear from Senator Booker. I thank him. And I thank a number of others who have done this, including the heads of state, scholars, and activists in the Caribbean, are playing a leading role in the global reparation movement. Many have been inspired by our work. I'm delighted to see that Professor Sir Hilary Beckles, Vice Chancellor of the University of West Indies and Chairman of CARICOM Reparations Commission, has traveled all the way from Jamaica to be here. Thank you. I am particularly glad that we're coming together as brothers and sisters and passing out accolades. I want to certainly acknowledge NCOBRA for its steadfast leadership on this issue over the years and playing an instrumental role in garnering sponsors of H.R. 40. We're also delighted that several members of the National African American Reparations Commission are present. We want to thank them for working closely with the Dean, Congressman John Conyers, in reforming H.R. 40 into a bill to study reparations. I'm delighted to have reintroduced it with its modification and carrying it forward to its next level. Thank you, Dr. Ron Daniels. We thank you for your leadership. Look forward to working with you in the National African American Reparations Commission as we educate the nation on the importance of enacting H.R. 40. And I'd like to thank Reverend Al Sharpton, National Action Network Convention, because he asked 15 presidential candidates what their position was, and we now have raised this to a national level. I just simply ask, why not? And why not now? If not all of us, then who? God bless us as we pursue the final justice for those who lived in slavery for 250 years in the United States of America. Please support H.R. 40 to its passage and signature by the President of the United States. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your generosity and kindness. I yield back.
Thank you.
That was Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat from Texas, sponsor of H.R. 40.
Which was
While the committee is taking care of procedural details, we're going to go a few minutes late to our scheduled 7:30 news break with Eileen Alfenberry.
It's 7:38. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. This is special live coverage on the first congressional hearing on reparations for African Americans since 2007. It's being convened by a subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee as a hearing on House Resolution 40. It has been numbered that way since 1989, a reference to Army Special Field Order No. 15 from the Civil War, which promised up to 40 farmable acres and a mule to work it to every freed slave. We're going to rejoin the hearing with testimony from the first witness. This is Cory Booker, Democratic senator from New Jersey, who is sponsoring the companion bill to H.R. 40 in the Senate.
That has tainted this country's founding and continues to persist in those deep racial disparities and inequalities today. This is a very important hearing. It is historic. It is urgent. I look at communities like mine, and you could literally see how communities were designed to be segregated, designed based upon enforcing institutional racism and inequities. We know that racialized violence and terrorism has persisted from Reconstruction well into the 1950s, as my friend Brian Stevenson's National Memorial for Peace and Justice shows. We've seen bombings of churches. We've seen massacres at places as recently as the Emmanuel AME Church just 4 years ago. The stain of slavery was not just inked in bloodshed, but in the overt state-sponsored policies that fueled white supremacy and racism and have disadvantaged African Americans economically for generations. Many of the bedrock policies, in fact, that ushered generations of Americans into the middle class were designed to exclude African Americans, from the GI Bill to Social Security, intentionally designed to exclude blacks, as was school segregation, redlining, neighborhoods like the one in which I live, which were by design walled off and disinvested in. And while these policies of the past, their damage and their reality has endured across generations and have created and led to so much of the racial wealth gaps in our country. Right now, we see cities like Boston, where the average white family has somewhere around $240,000 in wealth, and the average black family has about $8 in wealth. Health outcomes also vary widely by race. National black women are nearly four times as likely to die from pregnancy complications as white women, and in so many other areas. Our criminal justice system as well. No difference between blacks and whites for using drugs or selling drugs, but African Americans are about four times more likely to be arrested. These injustices do not just cause injustice for African Americans. It enforces a deep injustice in our nation as a whole. It is a cancer on the soul of our country and hurts the whole body politic, making us all less wealthy, making us all less just, making us all fall far short from being who we say we are when we swear an oath that this will be a nation of liberty and justice for all. I believe this is an urgent moment, and this bill, which I am now leading on the Senate side, is the beginning of an important process, not just to examine and study this history that has not been addressed, the silence that persists, but also to find practical ideas to address the enduring injustices in our nation. The characterizations of such an effort that I hear from others is wrong and undermines our collective purpose and common ground. This idea that it's just about writing a check from one American to another falls far short of the importance of this conversation and what I believe we will truly talk about. I say that I am brokenhearted and angry right now. Decades of living in a community where you see how deeply unfair this nation is still to so many people who struggle, who work hard, who do everything right but still find themselves disproportionately with lead in their water, superfunds in their neighborhood, schools that don't serve their genius, healthcare disparities that still affect their body and their well-being. We as a nation must address these persistent inequalities, or we will never fully achieve the strength and the possibility. Hope is the active conviction that despair will not have the last word. I believe right now, today, we have a historic opportunity to break the silence, to speak to the ugly past, and talk constructively about how we will move this nation forward. As the old African saying says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. It's about time we find the common ground and the common purpose to deal with the ugly past and make sure that generations ahead do not have to continue to mark disparities, but can truly talk about a nation where, as our ancestors spoke from the good book, where justice rolls down like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much, Senator Booker. I
appreciate Senator Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey, 2020 presidential candidate, first witness in the House Judiciary Committee hearing on H.R. 40.
Congressman Al Green was here, and he's a great champion. Now I'd like to call upon our second panel and thank Senator Booker for his sponsorship and his statement and wonderful words. Thank you, sir. Second panel, if they'd come forward, I guess we need chairs. There we go. The chair crowd is here. Good.
This is live coverage of the first congressional hearing on reparations for African Americans since 2007. It is the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Technically a hearing on House Resolution 40. It's had the same number since it was first enrolled by John Conyers in 1989. It would form a commission with a budget of about $12 million to study and propose reparations to African Americans. The companion bill in the Senate, which Cory Booker is sponsoring, has the same number. The significance of the number, it's a reference to Special Field Order Number 15, a special order from the Civil War era, approved by Abraham Lincoln, that promised up to 40 farmable acres and a mule to work it to African Americans freed from slavery by the Emancipation Proclamation. A portrait of John Conyers,
Shelton,
who is now out of Congress after a Me Too scandal, is hanging over the hearing room as the next panel is assembling. The members of that panel are going to include Atlantic staff writer Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of an article in 2014 entitled The Case for Reparations that made the cover of The Atlantic, actor and UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador for the UN, Danny Glover, Catherine Brown, a documentarian who worked on the film Traces of the Trade, The Economist, Dr. Julianne Malveaux, and many, many more. It is a quite large panel that is assembling in the hearing room at the moment. And there is a crowd of photographers around the committee as it assembles. The voices you've been hearing, the chair presiding over this hearing is Subcommittee Chair Steve Cohen. He is one of a very small number of white Democrats who represent majority black districts. He's from the Memphis area of Tennessee. Let's go back to rejoin the hearing proceedings.
Participating in today's hearing. Your written statement will be entered into the record in its entirety, and I ask you to summarize your testimony in 5 minutes. There's a lighting system. Green means you're on. Blue means you've got... No, yellow means you got a minute left, and red, you're over. Cut. Finished. Before proceeding, I remind each witness that your written and oral statements made to the subcommittee in connection with this hearing are subject to penalties of perjury pursuant to 18 U.S.C. 1001, which may result in the imposition of a fine or imprisonment of up to 5 years. Our first witness is Ta-Nehisi Coates. If I mispronounce it, I'm sorry. Chris Hayes didn't teach me well when we first met. Mr. Coates is an author and distinguished writer in residence at the New York University Carter Journalism Institute, a position he's held since 2017. He's held a variety of academic positions since 2010. Additionally, from 2008 to 2018, he was a national correspondent for The Atlantic, where he wrote an extensive piece in June 2014 on the case for reparations. I believe he also addressed Rhodes College on that subject sometime in Memphis, Tennessee. He's the author of 3 books, numerous articles, and blog posts. Mr. Coates, thank you for being here, and you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Ta-Nehisi Coates taking
Yesterday,
the podium.
Yesterday, when asked about reparations, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell offered a familiar reply. America should not be held liable for something that happened 150 years ago, since none of us currently alive are responsible. This rebuttal proffers a strange theory of governance, that American accounts are somehow bound by the lifetime of its generations. But well into this century, the United States was still paying out pensions to the heirs of Civil War soldiers. We honor treaties that date back some 200 years, despite no one being alive who signed those treaties. Many of us would love to be taxed for the things we are solely and individually responsible for. But we are American citizens and thus bound to a collective enterprise that extends beyond our individual and personal reach. It would seem ridiculous to dispute invocations of the founders or the greatest generation on the basis of a lack of membership in either group. We recognize our lineage as a generational trust, as inheritance. And the real dilemma posed by reparations is just that. A dilemma of inheritance. It is impossible to imagine America without the inheritance of slavery. As historian Ed Baptist has written, enslavement, quote, shaped every crucial aspect of the economy and politics of America, so that by 1836, more than 600 million, or almost half of the economic activity in the United States, derived directly or indirectly from the cotton produced by the million-odd slaves. By the time the enslaved were emancipated, they comprised the largest single asset in America. $3 billion in 1860 dollars, more than all the other assets in the country combined. The method of cultivating this asset was neither gentle cajoling nor persuasion, but torture, rape, and child trafficking. Enslavement reigned for 250 years on these shores. When it ended, this country could have extended its hallowed principles, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to all regardless of color. But America had other principles in mind. And so for a century after the Civil War, black people were subjected to a relentless campaign of terror, a campaign that extended well into the lifetime of Majority Leader McConnell. It is tempting to divorce this modern campaign of terror, of plunder, from enslavement. But the logic of enslavement, of white supremacy, respects no such borders. And the god of bondage was lustful and begat many heirs. coup d'etats and convict leasing, vagrancy laws and debt peonage, redlining and racist GI bills, poll taxes and state-sponsored terrorism. We grant that Mr. McConnell was not alive for Appomattox, but he was alive for the electrocution of George Stinney. He was alive for the blinding of Isaac Woodward. He was alive to witness kleptocracy in his native Alabama and a regime premised on electoral theft. Majority Leader McConnell cited civil rights legislation yesterday, as well he should, because he was alive to witness the harassment, jailing, and betrayal of those responsible for that legislation by a government sworn to protect them. He was alive for the redlining of Chicago and the looting of black homeowners of some $4 billion. Victims of that plunder are very much alive today. I am sure they'd love a word with the majority leader. What they know, what this committee must know, is that while emancipation deadbolted the door against the bandits of America, Jim Crow wedged the windows wide open. And that is the thing about Senator McConnell's something. It was 150 years ago, and it was right now. The typical black family in this country has 1/10 the wealth of the typical white family. Black women die in childbirth at 4 times the rate of white women. And there is, of course, the shame of this land of the free, boasting the largest prison population on the planet, of which the descendants of the enslaved make up the largest share. The matter of reparations is one of making amends and direct redress, but it is also a question of citizenship. In H.R. 40, this body has a chance to both make good on its 2009 apology for enslavement and reject fair-weather patriotism, to say that a nation is both its credits and its debits, that if Thomas Jefferson matters, so does Sally Hemings, that if D-Day matters, so does Black Wall Street, that if Valley Forge matters, so does Fort Pillow. Because the question really is not whether we will be tied to the somethings of our past, but whether we are courageous enough to be tied to the whole of them. Thank you.
That was author and journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, witness in the House Judiciary Committee Subcommittee on H.R. 40, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparations Proposals for African Americans Act.
Actor, a producer, and an activist for various causes. He's currently Goodwill
Ambassador. Next witness to testify at the hearing will be Danny Glover.
Chairman of the Board of Trans-Africa Forum, an African-American lobbying organization for Africa and the Caribbean, and a friend of Harry Belafonte. You're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you.
Start the clock.
Thank you, Mr. Coates. It's not often that you hear the words of a young man and they enliven your emotional memory, your historic memory, as he just did at this moment. Thank you so much. I am deeply honored to be here today, offering my testimony at this historic meeting about the reckoning of a crime against humanity that is foundational to the development of democracy and material well-being in this country. A national reparations policy is a moral, democratic, and economic imperative. I sit here as the great-grandson of a former slave, Mary Brown, who was freed by the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863. I had the fortune of meeting her as a small child. I also sit here as the grandson of Reese May Huntley and Rufus Mack Huntley, my maternal grandparents, who were both born before Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court decision in 1896. And for a significant portion of their lives, they worked as sharecroppers and tenant farmers in rural Georgia until they were able to save enough money to purchase a small farm. They were subsistent farmers. Despite much progress over the centuries, This hearing is yet another important step in the long and heroic struggle of African Americans to secure reparations for the damages inflicted by enslavement and post-emancipation and racial exclusionary policies. Many of the organizations who are present today at this hearing are amongst the historical contributors to the present national discourse, congressional deliberations, and Democratic Party presidential campaign policy discussions about reparations. We are also indebted to the work of Congressman John Conyers for shepherding this legislation. The adoption of H.R. 40 can be a signature legislative achievement, especially within the context of the United Nations International Decade of People of African Descent. We should also note that the Common Market Nations and the Caribbean Community, CARICOM, Reparations Commission, chaired by Professor Sir Hilary Beckles, who is here with us today, has exercised a leadership role from which we as a nation can benefit. Our sustained, direct, effective policy actions in full collaboration with African Americans and progressive citizens, allies, is the ultimate proof of the sincerity of our national commitment to repair the damages of the legally and often religiously sanctioned inhumanity of slavery, segregation, and current structural racism that limit full democratic participation and material advancement of African Americans and of our country's progress as a beacon of justice and equality. So I call on all of the elected public officials in Congress to demonstrate your commitment in action today and stand forth with Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee and co-sign H.R. 40. In closing, with the insightful and still, with the insightful and still relevant words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. And I quote, "Why is the issue of equality still so far from solution in America, a nation which professes itself to be democratic, inventive, hospitable to new ideas, rich, productive, and ultimately powerful? Justice for black people will not flow into society merely from court decisions, nor from fountains of political oratory, nor will a few token changes quell all the tempestuous yearnings of millions of disadvantaged black people. White America must recognize that justice for black people cannot be achieved without radical changes in the structure of our society. The comfortable, the entrenched, the privileged cannot continue to tremble at the prospect of change in the status quo." Thank you.
Thank you.
That was actor and film director, political activist Danny Glover, witness in the House Judiciary Committee subcommittee on H.R. 40. And you are listening to KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, and K24ABR 97.5 in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org.
And this is live special coverage on Upfront of the first House hearing on reparations since 2007. Live testimony still to come will include Dr. Julianne Malveaux, Professor Eric J. Miller of Loyola Marymount University, Reverend Eugene Taylor Sutton of the Episcopal Bishop of Maryland, and a list of Republican witnesses who, as of yesterday, still had been not been announced by the committee. Well, we'll be endeavoring to bring you as much of the live proceedings as possible by the end of our time slot, but we're also trying to break you the news happening in the rest of the world. Right now, it's just past the 8 o'clock mark, and we will be back with the witness panel after these headlines.
Good morning. It's 8:06, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. And this morning, we're bringing you special live coverage of the first House hearing on reparations for African Americans held since 2007. We are, as we speak, partway through the witness testimony of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Technically, the occasion for the hearing is House Resolution 40, which would form a commission to study and propose reparations. Versions of this bill have been enrolled under this number since 1989, a reference to the 40 acres and a mule promise coming out of the Civil War. Testimony is just beginning from the Reverend Eugene Taylor Sutton, the Episcopal Bishop of Maryland. I'm sorry. It looks like the testimony we're hearing right now is from Coleman Hughes. Here we go.
Greatest injustices ever perpetrated by the U.S. government. But I worry that our desire to fix the past compromises our ability to fix the present. Think about what we're doing today. We're spending our time debating a bill that mentions slavery 25 times, but incarceration only once, in an era with no black slaves, but nearly a million black prisoners. A bill that doesn't mention homicide once, at a time when the Center for Disease Control reports homicide as the number one cause of death for young black men.
This is one of the Republican witnesses who had not been announced until as of yesterday. He's a writer for Quillette.
And allowing history to distract us from the problems we face today. In 2008, the House of Representatives formally apologized for slavery and Jim Crow. In 2009, the Senate did the same. Black people don't need another apology. We need safer neighborhoods and better schools. We need a less punitive criminal justice system. We need affordable health care. And none of these things can be achieved through reparations for slavery. Nearly everyone close to me told me not to testify today. They told me that even though I've only ever voted for Democrats, I'd be perceived as a Republican and therefore hated by half the country. Others told me that by distancing myself from Republicans, I would end up angering the other half of the country. And the sad truth is that they were both right. That's how suspicious we've become of one another. That's how divided we are as a nation. If we were to pay reparations today, we would only divide the country further, making it harder to build the political coalitions required to solve the problems facing black people today. We would insult many black Americans by putting a price on the suffering of their ancestors. And we would turn the relationship between black Americans and white Americans from a coalition into a transaction, from a union between citizens into a lawsuit between plaintiffs and defendants. What we should do is pay reparations to black Americans who actually grew up under Jim Crow and were directly harmed by second-class citizenship, people like my grandparents. But paying reparations to all descendants of slaves is a mistake. Take me, for example. I was born three decades after the end of Jim Crow into a privileged household in the suburbs. I attend an Ivy League school. Yet I'm also descended from slaves who worked on Thomas Jefferson's Monticello plantation. So reparations for slavery would allocate federal resources to me, but not to an American with the wrong ancestry, even if that person is living paycheck to paycheck and working multiple jobs to support a family. You might call that justice. I call it justice for the dead at the price of justice for the living. I understand that reparations are about what people are owed, regardless of how well they're doing. I understand that. But the people who are owed for slavery are no longer here, and we're not entitled to collect on their debts. Reparations, by definition, are only given to victims. So the moment you give me reparations, you've made me into a victim without my consent. Not just that, you've made one-third of black Americans who poll against reparations into victims without their consent. And black Americans have fought too long for the right to define themselves, to be spoken for in such a condescending manner. The question is not what America owes me by virtue of my ancestry. The question is what all Americans owe each other by virtue of being citizens of the same nation. And the obligation of citizenship is not transactional. It's not contingent on ancestry. It never expires, and it can't be paid off. For all these reasons, Bill H.R. 40 is a moral and political mistake. Thank you.
Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes.
That was Coleman Hughes, columnist
chill,
at Quillette.
Chill. He was presumptive.
One of the Republican witnesses
right
at today's hearing. They had not been announced as of late
Owens
yesterday.
Is recognized. Mr. Owens.
Some discord in the hearing chamber. This is a special live coverage of the first House hearing on the topic of reparations to African Americans to be held in the House of Representatives since 2007. This is the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Person trying to establish order right now is the subcommittee chair, Steve Cohen,
an author and a retired professional
Democrat from Tennessee,
for the New York Giants and the Oakland Raiders. He's the author of a number of books, including the 2016 book Liberalism, or How to Turn Good Men into Whiners, Weenies, and Wimps, which offers a history and analysis of the black experience in the United States. He attended the University of Miami, home of the Ibis, Blow Hurricane Blow. Mr. Owens, you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
This is Burgess Owens.
I'm going to take a different.
We're just finding out the identities of Republican witnesses as you are, because
point.
They
this is not about
weren't on the official
white,
roster as of
poor,
end of business yesterday.
Blue collar, white collar. We're fighting for the heart and soul of our nation. We have a very, very special country that started with the Judeo-Christian values that allowed every single generation to become better than the last. And that has not ended. That has not stopped until now. We're telling our kids a little bit something different, that they don't have the opportunities that we had. I'm going to talk about some ideologies. And when I talk about them, when I talk about people, people change. I used to be a Democrat until I did my history and found out the misery that that party brought to my race. So when I talk about these ideologies, ideologies don't change. People do. We're fighting for the heart and soul of our nation against socialism, Marxism, and the evil that it has brought to us in the stealing of our history. Karl Marx said it best, the father of socialism, an atheist, anti-Semite, and a blatant racist. Yet we teach his philosophy in our school systems today. He said it, the first battleground is rewriting of our history. You steal our history, you steal our pride in our past, our appreciation for our present, and our vision for our future. And every single urban city in our country is now experiencing that loss. Real quick history, because these are things we're not taught. I'm blessed to be the great-great-grandfather of Silas Burgess. Came here in the belly of a slave ship. Sold in Charleston, South Carolina with his mother to the Burgess Plantation. An evil, evil man that drove my great-great-great-grandmother either to leaving her family, her kids, or committing suicide. I don't know. She disappeared. But Silas, at age of eight, was blessed to be surrounded by men who believed in freedom. Even though they were shackled, they escaped. They went the southern route of the Underground Railroad, facilitated by white and Mexican Americans. And he's made his way out south to Texas. He ended up being a successful entrepreneur, owned 102 acres of land, paid off in 2 years. Started the first black church, the first black elementary school. Pillar of his community, 18 kids, Christian, Republican. His first son was Alpha Omega. Proud American. An example of what happens when any race, any culture is given hope, opportunity, and freedom. It didn't end there, by the way. The history of our black country, of our black Americans, has been stolen from us for decades, almost over a century. Booker T. Washington, 1882, began Tuskegee University. By 1905, it was producing more self-made black millionaires than Harvard, Yale, and Princeton combined. The 40s, 50s, and 60s, it was a black country, black community that led our country in the growth of the middle class. Led our country in terms of men committed to marriage, over 70%, now it's 30%. Led our country in terms of the commitment to business ownership, 40%, now it's 3.8%. men matriculated from college. We now have more, a higher percentage of men incarcerated in college. It is, by the way, my degree was biology. And that I learned a long time ago that slavery is not a gene in the DNA helix. It's our actions. It's our attitude. It's our belief. I do not believe in reparation, because what reparation does, it points to a certain race, a certain color, and it points them as evil, and points the other race, my race, as one that is not only becomes racist, but also beggars. I do believe in restitution. Let's point to the party that was part of slavery, KKK, Jim Crow, that has killed over 40% of our black babies, 20 million of them. State of California, 75% of our black boys cannot pass standard reading and writing tests, a Democratic state. So, yes, let's pay restoration. Let's pay restitution. How about a Democratic Party pay for all the misery brought to my race? And those, after we learn our history, decide to stay there. They should pay also. They're complicit. And every white American, Republican or Democrat, that feels guilty because of your white skin, you should need to pony up also. That way we can get past this reparation and recognize that this country has given us greatness. Look at this panel. It doesn't matter how we think. The fact is, well, it doesn't matter our color. We have become successful in this country like no other because of this great opportunity to live the American dream. Let's not steal that from our kids by telling them they can't do it. Thank you.
Our next witness, Republican witness, Clarence Burgess Owens, retired football player. He's a witness in the House Judiciary Subcommittee on H.R. 40, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparations Proposals for African Americans Act. We're covering it live this morning on Upfront.
We'll be staying with the committee hearing live through the end of the day. The topic under consideration, House Resolution 40, will create a commission whose members are appointed equally by the leaders of the House, the Senate, and the President of the United States with a $12 million budget, study the topic of reparations to African Americans, and make concrete proposals on how to carry them out. Go now to the next witness.
I am here today as a bishop of the Episcopal,
which is retired Reverend Eugene Taylor Sutton, Episcopal Bishop of Maryland, Democratic witness on the hearing.
In favor of the proposed legislation on reparations. I might say right at the outset, the debate we are having here this morning and the witness of my colleagues here points to the need to establish a commission. This debate needs to happen, and we need to entertain proposals for how we redress the evils of our past. If we don't address those problems in an open and fair way, then we are continuing to be lost as a nation. By the way, in terms of politics, some of my friends are for Democrats, and some of my friends are for Republicans. And as a religious leader, I am for my friends. I want to say that last month, the Episcopal Diocese of Maryland that I lead, 110 congregations across most of the state of Maryland, voted unanimously for the affirmation of reparations of our diocese, knowing that so many of the resources of our diocese was gained from uncompensated labor of enslaved persons. 100%, not a single negative vote from a diocese that is over 90% white, encompassing people from Western Maryland who have their own history of injustices, coal miners and others, Southern Maryland suburbs and city people. How and why did that happen? If it could happen in that diocese, I'm convinced it can happen in America. It happened because when the subject, when the issue of reparations are fairly and fully explained, Americans want to do the right thing. That issue of reparations is mired in emotion. It's often mischaracterized and certainly largely misunderstood. It wells up an emotional response in people to the word. But when you break it down on what it's actually to do, we find that many of those emotions dissipate. Why is there a need for it? Let me tell you the story of a friend of mine. She and her husband, she was a pastor of a congregation. And a long time ago, she told this story of when their child was young, there was a young girl, a young teenager in the congregation who knew they had a need for babysitting, and she said, I'll sit for your son tonight. And then she volunteered again. And then my friend and her husband started calling on her more and more, would you do this? Would you do this? Never was the issue of money brought up. They knew she volunteered at first, but she, the teenager, wanted to do this for that more powerful person in that church. That went on for years. After a while, my friend and her husband thought, this was unfair. This actually was an injustice toward her. They wrote her a letter, then now in college, and they said, we believe, we have come to know that this was an injustice. We are sorry. We want to make amends. The young woman wrote back, thank you. And then they worked out a way that she could be compensated for her years of work. Their relationship was reconciled. They could look each other in the eye in a way that they could not before, because that wall of injustice of that past got in the way of their current relationship. That's what reparations is. And that's what our nation has failed to do for the last 120 years. Reparations quite simply means to repair that which has been broken. It is not just about monetary compensation. An act of reparation is an attempt to make whole again, to restore, to offer atonement, to make amends, to reconcile for a wrong or an injury. It is not the transfer of money from white people to black people. It is what this generation, our generation, will do to repair the broken pieces of the racial mess that we have all inherited. As an African American who is a descendant of slaves who were never compensated, I can honestly say to all white people, we've forgiven you. We forgave this country a long time ago, and we continue to forgive every day, but we are not reconciled. To reconcile means to put back together again that which has been broken. After the hard-fought abolition of slavery, there was a fateful denial in our nation of reparations for freed American African-American people, even though in many instances, white plantation owners received reparations in the form of compensation for the losses they incurred from the Civil War and the end of slavery. This nation is not, we know about reparations, it's just that it's never been done for those who've deserved it the most. Finally, I'm a Christian. That means I hold to the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testaments as my guidepost and to the teachings of Jesus. The Bible mandates that leaders are to be held accountable for the fair and equal treatment of every inhabitant in the land. All of us have been taught to love everyone, regardless of their race and human condition. However, we must come to acknowledge that there can be no love without justice, and there can be no justice without some form of repairing an injustice. I hear from many of my white friends, white brothers and sisters, this question. What do black people want? Haven't we done enough? What do they want? I want to turn the question around. What do you want? What kind of America do you want to live in? If you are happy with the state of race relations now, don't do anything on this issue. But if you want a reconciled nation, let's get this commission and let's entertain those proposals.
Thank you very much, Reverend.
That's the right, Reverend Eugene Taylor Sutton, nationally known for his commitment to nonviolence and reconciliation. He's a Democratic witness on the House Judiciary Subcommittee on H.R. 40, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparations Proposals for African Americans Act.
Dr. Malvo is a labor economist, noted author, and
next witness is Julianne Malvo, economist, political commentator, sometime guest on this radio station. We'll carry the entirety of her testimony that may require pushing back 8:30 news headlines by a few minutes, but we will go to those after she's done. Back to proceedings on the floor of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties hearing on reparations for African Americans.
He also served
As the 15th president of Bennett College for Women, America's oldest historically black women's college, received her PhD in economics from MIT and her bachelor's and master's degrees from Boston College. Thank you for your coming, and you're recognized for 5 minutes.
Chair Cohen, thank you so very much for this opportunity. I also want to thank my sister friend, Congresswoman.
The mic may not be on.
Okay, it's sorry about that.
What talk, you talk.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to thank my sister friend, Dr. Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, and my twin sister over there, Congresswoman Karen Bass. People frequently comment on our resemblance. And of course, Congressman Nadler, for your work and your leadership, Keenan, and Dr. Ron Daniels, who was here and has been mentioned, for his leadership of NARC, the National African American Reparations Commission, on which I serve. I am delighted to be here because this hearing is not on time, it's like overtime. It's more than time for us to deal with the injustices that African American people not only have experienced in history, but continue to experience. I'm an economist, so economics is a study of who gets what, when, where, and why. It's a study of the way the factors of production are paid. The elements are land, labor, capital, and the secret sauce. Some people call it entrepreneurial ability. Some call it creativity. Land gets rent, labor gets wages, capital gets interest, and the secret sauce gets profits. But the work of predatory capitalists is to figure out how to extract more from the factors of production toward capital and away from people. And we've seen that in the past 3 decades with our own economy. But more importantly, enslavement was about the devil's work of predatory capitalism. Indeed, enslaved people got no wages, and we represented capital for other people. And so after enslavement, first of all, enslavement was the foundation on which our country was built. So anybody who says, well, I didn't have any slaves, no, you didn't have to have any. What you had to do was experience them, enjoy the fact that they were here, enjoy the fact that their labor made it possible for there to be a Wall Street, a bond market, and all of that. But beyond that, I want to speak specifically to Section 3B3 of the legislation. That's the part that talks about the federal and state laws that discriminate against formerly enslaved Africans and their descendants who are deemed United States citizens. From Robert Higgs in a book called Competition and Coercion, Blacks in the American Economy, 1865 to 1914, he shows that in 1880, the ratio of black to white wealth was one black dollar for 36 white dollars. 1890, 1 to 26. 1900, 1 to 23. 1910, 1 to 16. Today, 1 to 20. In other words, we're almost worse off in 2019 than we were in 1910 because of evil. Because basically there have been deliberate attempts to marginalize African-American people, especially those who are formerly enslaved, because of the interests of predatory capitalism, and because it was expedient to maintain the status quo of having free black labor and to prevent wealth accumulation. Despite the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, black people were treated as other and perniciously and viciously excluded from the possibilities of economic advancement. The Emergency Land Fund documented the reduction of black land ownership between 1910 and 1969 from 16 million acres to 6 million acres. How and why? Land grabs, tax schemes, faulty deeds, and downright force. My own family in Moss Point, Mississippi, experienced the expropriation of land through a moving fence, like the fence moved one night. We used to have the land, and we didn't have the land. Years later, after a couple cousins were lynched, they changed the name of the land to Hawkins Lane, so they named it after us, but we didn't get it back. Joseph Brooks in 1978 estimated that black folks were losing 6,000 acres of land per week. And we saw what happened with the Agriculture Department. The post-enslavement case for reparations can be made by examining racially hostile public policy and government complicity to white supremacy. You all have an article that I wrote for the ACLU that talks about several cases, Memphis, Wilmington, North Carolina, Tulsa, Oklahoma. But these were the tip of the iceberg. This happened everywhere. The journalist Ida B. Wells said that lynching was the first example of white supremacy because it was a tool of terrorism. It dampened the ability of African-American people to participate in the vibrant entrepreneurship of the late 19th and early 20th century with a chilling message that our economic success could be punished by the rope. The economic damage to black people post-Reconstruction can be summarized in 3 ways. Number one, we were denied the ability to participate in our nation's economic growth. The Homestead Act of 1862 did not include formerly enslaved people. More than 10% of the continental U.S. land was distributed to recent immigrants from Europe, but not black folks. So the 40 acres and a mule was given to somebody else, not us. These folks were able not only to get land, but then to get grants from the federal government to develop their land. Meanwhile, African-American people were denied the right to these wealth transfers. Secondly, we were denied the right to accumulate. The attached of the paper that I mentioned talks about how our accumulation was essentially stymied by lynching. The first lynching that Ida B. Wells examined was one when a black man had the nerve, the utter nerve, to open up a grocery store near a white man's store. So the white man had a brother lynched, had three people lynched because of economic envy. Listen to those words, economic envy. This is how black people have been suppressed in their ability to accumulate. Tulsa, Oklahoma, Wilmington, North Carolina, long stories, and I don't have any time to talk about them. But I want y'all to look at the paper that I submitted and to think about the many ways that black people who tried to participate, tried to encourage, tried to be American, simply tried to be economic actors, were suppressed because they had the nerve to think it worked. So my brothers over here who say their American dream is some people's American nightmare. Let's just be clear. Now, number three is public policy hostility. There was public policy hostility to black people. GI Bill legislation truncated opportunities for African-American veterans. Federal Housing Administration reinforced redlining and segregation as an official policy of the federal government. People talk about racists as if they're individuals. Yes, sir. But the fact is they're not individuals. They're individuals who are buttressed by the federal government and legislation. So let me simply say H.R. 40 is important. NARC has developed a 10-point plan, but more importantly, as you, my brothers and sisters on this Congress, go forward, may there be a racial justice audit of any new legislation that has economic implications. Thank you.
That was Dr. Julianne Malveaux, African-American economist, author, and social and political commentator, Democratic witness in the House Judiciary Subcommittee on H.R. 40, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparations Proposals for African Americans Act.
We're bringing you live coverage on Upfront of that hearing, which is underway as we speak. We're going to break away for a few minutes to bring you, a few minutes late, our scheduled news break. Then we'll return to the proceedings. Here's Eileen Alfandary.
Good morning. It's 8:37. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Janine Etter.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert. This morning, we're bringing you a special live broadcast from the proceedings of the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Race, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties hearing on H.R. 40, a bill number that since 1989 has been assigned to a bill that would form a commission to study and propose reparations to African Americans. It is the first hearing on reparations in Congress since 2007, and it is underway even as we speak. Over the course of the past hour and 30-some-odd minutes of hearings, we have heard from Ta-Nehisi Coates, Danny Glover, the Reverend Eugene Taylor Sutton, as well as a handful of Republican witnesses. Currently on the testifying stand, Professor Eric J. Miller with Loyola Marymount University. He's an expert on policing and racialized policing in the United States. Let's rejoin for the tail end of his testimony.
Including historians, lawyers, and activists to report on the massacre. The commission's painstaking research through the historical record discovered much previously unavailable material. The commission apportioned detailed financial damages and proposed that reparations be paid to the survivors and descendants. When the state refused to make good on these recommendations, we filed a lawsuit trying to complete the process begun by the commission. The only impediment to our success, the court acknowledged, was a rule requiring the survivors to file any lawsuit within 2 years of the injury. These statutes of limitations are the major impediment to many reparations lawsuits. The Tulsa experience demonstrates that the harms of slavery and segregation scar our communities to this day. The city and state dismantled economically, politically, and culturally a specific community, African Americans in Tulsa. Subsequent generations of Greenwood residents have labored under the social and political disempowerment whilst trying to rebuild their community. The Tulsa experience is emblematic of many African-American communities around this country. So whilst a monetary payment would count as a beginning, economic justice is not enough without racial justice to repair the specific race-based wrongs of the Tulsa massacre and its aftermath. To quote Harvard Law professor and reparations activist Charles Ogletree, reparations are more than an exercise in education, remembrance, and apology. Reparations demand the political, social, and economic power inequality for African Americans that has been stifled and suppressed in America since its inception. Accordingly, I urge Congress to pass H.R. 40 as a first vital step on the path to acknowledging and accounting for the history of race-targeted discrimination and wrongdoing that has marked too much of this nation's history.
Thank you, Professor Miller.
That's Professor Eric Miller, Professor of Criminal Procedure with a focus on police at Loyola Marymount University.
Tulsa riot, he was referencing 1921, group of whites attacking blacks. Official death count, 36 people.
35 years of racist housing.
This is the chair of the committee, Stephen Cohen, Democrat from Tennessee, representing the Memphis area, opening up the Q&A period for House of Representatives members of the committee to interact with the witnesses. First question goes to Ta-Nehisi Coates.
I think the most obvious reason is because the federal government is complicit in it. The article that you spoke about, this period of white supremacy that you referenced in the headline, it is so broad that if I tried to cover it in one article, it would have been impossible. So I focused on a very specific thing, and that is the period of Jim Crow and housing segregation and redlining, specifically in the city of Chicago. The federal government should pay because the federal government was deeply complicit in housing segregation and redlining and in the plunder of black homeowners in Chicago. It would not have existed if the FHA had not had a policy of not insuring loans for black people living in Chicago. It would not have existed if not for the redlining maps, which were written and created by this government of every major city in the country, which effectively relegated black people, whether they had a down payment or not, outside of a class of people who could benefit from a movement which basically created our modern middle class. And so I don't know how it would be possible to exempt the federal government from such a process. And furthermore, I have to make this point over and over. Many of the people who were victimized by housing segregation and by redlining are very much alive today. So this is not strictly about the past. This is identifiable victims, as Dr. Miller, as Professor Miller said, who are there and who are ready and to be part of the process.
Thank you, sir. Reverend Sutton, let me ask you, you heard Mr. Hughes' testimony and said he didn't want reparations.
Yes.
Do you believe, and this would be a study of reparations, H.R. 40 draws no conclusions, it would be a study, do you believe that there should be exclusions for wealthy folks who have been successful and maybe emphasize deeds and works and actions that help the people who have not achieved as much and lift them up?
This question directed at Republican witness writer Coleman Hughes.
Why it was so widely accepted in my diocese. I'm sorry.
I believe one of the reasons why the vote for reparations is so widely accepted
that
in my diocese is because
looks
we
like
separated
it's going to Reverend
it from,
Eugene Taylor Sutton, the Episcopal Bishop of Maryland.
Black descendants of slaves getting checks. We're talking about funding initiatives, programs, addressing issues such as mass incarceration. And when that's explained to people that that's a reparation, that's repairing something that can be traced to slavery, then that is the case. Personally, I'm not looking for a check from the federal government or from my church or anything. I'm concerned about those who have been left behind, the masses of African-American descendants of slaves who are mired in hopelessness and despair in communities of crime, violence, poverty, and racism. And so I think if we can at least have a civil, good conversation on the concept of reparations, then talk about money. Because the moment you start talking about money, the idea, especially among many white persons, I'm going to give a check to black persons, what about me? The moment you begin with money, then the resistance goes up. Let's talk about the concept. Finally, in relation to your question, we have a problem in this nation of being able to talk civilly about race. And when I'm talking for reparations, I'm talking about those left behind, but I'm actually talking to my white brothers and sisters. You need this more than we do. You need this for your soul. You need this to be able to look black persons in the eye and say, I acknowledge the mistake, and I want to be part of the solution to repair that damage.
Thank you, Reverend Sutton. And as Reverend Sutton speaks to the soul, Dr. Malvo, you speak to the economics. And if some of this efforts to remediate the past, as Dr. Ogletree has spoken about, massive influx of monies for health and education and job training, if some of that went into areas where there are large concentrations of descendants of slaves that have not succeeded for a myriad of reasons, and if some of that went to white folks who are there who also are living in bad conditions, would that be a problem, do you think, Dr. Malbo, or would that just be helping everybody that's in a miasma?
Chairman Cohen, it's really interesting that right this minute, as we're having this hearing, Reverend William Barber is having a hearing on poverty. Mm-hmm. So this is a great day for economic justice issues. Poverty is a problem in our nation, but you can't fix poverty, nor can you fix inequality unless you deal with racism. And dealing with racism is about dealing with reparations. I'm with the Reverend here, and I don't care about a personal check made out to Julianne Malvo or anybody else, but how about we fully fund our historically black colleges and universities? How about, once upon a time, Brother Chairman, we had more than 100 black-owned banks. Now we have 23. How come? Again, the devil is busy. Pernicious legislation that basically caused people to lose banks, changing in reserve requirements and things like that. Gentrification, while you have empty swathes of land all over our nation, why not deal with that? So I respect your question about areas, but I think that really does speak to our dis-ease, our uneasiness in talking straight upfront about race. Race is our nation's second original sin. The first was what we did to Native people. Okay, but racism, enslavement was our original sin, and we got to deal with reparations by dealing exactly with that. If we want to have an American Marshall Plan that deals with all poor people, Reverend Barber says there are 140 million poor people, 43% of our nation, let's deal with that. But let's not forget that race is central to anything we do around economic justice.
Thank you, Doctor. My time expired, and I recognize the ranking member, Mr. Johnson, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, thank you to all of you for your time and your heartfelt sentiments. And
Republican Mike Johnson of Louisiana.
Mr. Hughes, I want to thank you for your honesty and your humility and your courage, sir. I know this isn't easy today. Here's a big question that hangs over all this and that all of us need to, I guess, address. Look, many people believe on all sides of the political spectrum that racial inequality that we see today is not entirely attributable to the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow. It's a factor, but it's not entirely attributable. Can you elaborate on what some of the other causative factors may be?
Question directed to Republican witness Reverend
Coleman Hughes. The first thing I would say is that blaming slavery and Jim Crow for the entirety of racial disparity, obviously it's clearly a factor, but blaming it for the entirety of the problems we see today facing black people is actually a way of not taking responsibility for policy decisions that were made just in the last 50 years. Our prisons did not balloon until the 1980s. Unemployment for black and white youths were virtually identical until the late 1950s and early 1960s. So by blaming slavery and Jim Crow for everything, we actually fail to take responsibility for policy decisions that were made on both sides of the aisle in very recent history. Secondly, I would say that there is a naive assumption that wherever there is a statistical gap in outcomes between two groups, that gap must be attributable to some kind of discrimination, whether that's overt or whether that's structural and systemic. That assumption is not true. Okay, just I'll give one example, but I could give dozens. According to 2015 census figures, there's a 21 cent on the dollar gap. It's 21 cents on the dollar gap in household income between white Americans of Russian descent and white Americans of French descent, right? Disparity is the norm, not the exception. So the question is not why two groups would have different outcomes, whether it's for wealth, income, or incarceration. The question is why we would expect any two groups with different histories, different geographical patterns, different patterns of migration, different cultures, to nevertheless get exactly the same outcomes.
Thank you for that. Mr. Owens, thank you as well. And I was moved by your testimony about the fact that we're fighting for the heart of our nation. I think everybody in this room as part of the American family understands that. We see it different ways. Here's a question. In your opinion, is there a formula that allowed the African-American community to achieve the measures of success it did during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s that is missing today?
There is, and I'm going to point to Booker T. Washington to tell
question
you what that's
directed
definitely
to retired
about.
Football player, Burgess Owens.
Things, square a few things away. I've been talking about restitution a little bit ago, and I have so much respect for the black men and women who built that great Wall Street, little side out of Tulsa. Not only did they had 60 millionaires, they had international business. Within 12 hours, it was destroyed from the air by Democratic KKK. Weren't a lot of white, I mean, they're white people, yes, but they're part of a certain party. The 40 acres and a mule, that was actually implemented. But when the Democratic president, Andrew Johnson, took over, they took that land back. They took away the guns, and then they took away their land. KKK, that's not a Democratic Party, by the way. They lynched 4,700 people. 1,300 of them were white Republicans. So, yes, we have a lot of evil going on. But let's not broad brush this, guys. There's a certain ideology. There's certain people that belong to a certain area, a certain niche. We need to hold them accountable. And so let's do that, and I think we'll be in good shape. Booker T. Washington had four foundations. It was head, heart, hands, and home. In that process, head is education, heart is compassion service, hands is industry, entrepreneurship, home is family. The reason why that my race were kicking butt, the history is not being told. They were beating, they were so busy, they weren't looking at finding somebody to blame for where they were. They were busy beating out these races. That's what my parents did. At the end of the day, they held on to those principles for decades. Until the socialists and Marxists got into our community and they stopped educating our kids. I said something earlier, and it has not been a gasp. 75%, 2017, Department of Education study, 75% of black boys in the state of California cannot pass standard reading and writing tests. And you wonder where they're going to go from here. They're not going to learn anything about our country. They're not going to read about our God. They're going to hear anything about what we, the people, have done together. They're going to turn on BET and hear how bad they're being treated. They're going to hear how bad our country is, how bad white people are. They're going to be taught how to disrespect our women, and they're going to be put in jail, and then we're going to sit around talking about why is this being done. Let's put a commission together. Why is this happening where so many of our kids are not being educated in every single urban American country and city in our country? That is what our problem is. As we ho-hum and we blame people from years ago, we have yet to put together a commission. How about this one? 82% of black teen males across our country last 8 years, unemployed, soon to become unemployable. 93% in our liberal city of Chicago, where they were killing each other right and left. And it's not one commission, not one peep about this misery that's going on in our country. I have something that I put in my book. I'm going to read this real quickly. Evil is purposeful stealing of the hopes and dreams and future of an individual. Pure evil is a target of a race of millions and using human misery as political strategy to steal their hopes, dreams, and future. We are dealing with pure evil. To have my race dealing with the evil, the misery that we've been dealing with, and no one says a word other than let's look back and see what can happen for 200 years ago. Let's deal with today, and I think we'll be in good shape.
Thank you for that. I'm out of time. I yield back.
The gentleman's time has expired. Thank you very much. The chairman of the
Judiciary Committee. Again, that was Republican questioning of a Republican witness, retired football player Burgess Owens. And that almost does it for this morning's live coverage of the first congressional hearing on reparations for African Americans to be held in 12 years since 2007. This has been the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. The topic of the hearing, House Resolution 40. Enrolled under that number since it was initially introduced by Representative John Conyers in 1989, would establish a commission to study reparations and make proposals for reparations, a commission with a budget of about $12 million. So far, that sparsely funded commission has not won passage in Congress or ever been signed into law. The number, H.R. 40, a reference to Special Field Order Number 15 during the Civil War, a special order signed off on by President Lincoln, promising an agrarian reform that would deliver up to 40 farmable acres and later a mule to work it to every African American freed from slavery by the Emancipation Proclamation. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert in KPFA studios with Janine Etter, who organized this morning's live broadcast. What do you think of the hearing?
I was very encouraged to hear so many eloquent speakers. Today we heard from Cory Booker, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who is on the floor now, Danny Glover. We didn't hear from Katrina Brown. She's actually a filmmaker and documentarian. She produced Traces in the Trade, a story from the Deep South, and she discovered that her New England ancestors were the largest slave trading family in U.S. history. We heard from Reverend Eugene Taylor Sutton and Julianne Malvo and Professor Eric Miller, and as well as a handful of Republican
witnesses had not been announced until today. We were trying to get a list yesterday when we were preparing this coverage, and none was available. What they came up with was a very young writer who says he votes for Democrats but is dubious about financial reparations, which is not necessarily what's on the table, and a retired football player. Ranking
who
Republican.
Who blames Democrats for...
Yeah, ranking Republican on the committee during his opening arguments fell back on, I understand racism because I've adopted a black son, and when I ask him, he doesn't support reparations.
Right. And there's the retired football player.
Burgess Owens.
Burgess.
In any case, that's all the time we have to bring you the proceedings of this morning. We'll have a wrap-up on the remainder of the hearing on tonight's evening news at 6 o'clock. But that does it for Upfront today. We air weekday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m. Post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media. If you want to sound off about something you heard or suggest something for us to cover, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org.
A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Producers Corinne Smith, engineers Kirsten Thomas, hosts are Brian Edwards-Tiekert, Kat Brooks, and me, Janine Etter, on Fridays. Interns are Justin Gold, Casey Repke, and Elizabeth Saul. Also, thanks to Ms. Jeserich and Eileen Alfandari.
Stay up, stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way in 2 minutes at 9 o'clock.
This is a listing of upcoming events in the Bay Area. All events are wheelchair accessible. Aya De Leon invites you to a discussion about her new novel, Side Chick Nation. Book sales benefit the Aurora Levens Morales Rebuilding Puerto Rico Initiative. This event takes place Thursday, June 27th at 7:30 p.m. at Pegasus Books, 2349 Shattuck Avenue in Berkeley. For details, call 510-649-1320. From executive producer Kevin Durant, the Wind Rider Film Forum presents Cue Ball, a documentary about the San Quentin Warriors, a group of incarcerated men playing competitive basketball to educate, rehabilitate, and help them rebuild their lives. The screening takes place on Thursday, June 27th at 7 p.m. at the Menlo Atherton Performing Arts Center, 555 Middlefield Road in Atherton. For details, call 650-322-5311. Polyglamorous and the Great Northern present Pink Block, a daytime indoor-outdoor block party for Pride Weekend. This event takes place Saturday, June 29th from noon to 9 p.m. at 119 Utah Street in San Francisco. For details, call 415-626-7001. The community calendar is produced by the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 4 weeks in advance to KPFA, Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, 94704, or email calendar at kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
You are tuned to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley.